gentlemen, may I have your attention?
Comunidad, welcome to another episode of Radio Teco, the podcast of the legacy bilingual Latino San Francisco-based newspaper, El Tecolote. My name is Alexis Terrazas, editor-in-chief, and I am incredibly proud to be able to introduce our latest guest. Now, before I kick this episode over to my co-host, good friend, and diehard soccer fanatic, Monty Rossetti, let me tell you all about our next guest, and that is retired professional Mexican-American soccer player, Hercules Gomez. Now, Hercules' story isn't just one about sports, it's also about identity, resilience, and perseverance. The son of Mexican migrants from Los Altos de Jalisco, shout out to all my Jalisco fan by the way, Hercules represented the United States in the 2010 World Cup, and is now a bilingual broadcaster with both ESPN and ESPN Deportes. But this isn't my interview or story to tell. So with that, I'll step aside and let Monty run the show.
All right, the moment has arrived. We've got Hercules Gomez. Hercules, first off, most importantly, I just want to ask, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Monty. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Thank you for asking. So let's go to kind of the origin story. So you're Mexican-American. Both of your parents were born in Mexico. Is that right?
Correct. They were born in Los Altos de Jalisco, which is a little towns outside of Guadalajara, which is a city in the state of Jalisco in Mexico. But funny enough, they met each other here in the States. My dad went to like Santa Monica High. My mom went to like Venice High here in LA. Met each other, you know, fell in love, did the thing. And then years later, I'm here. I'm the oldest of five.
So how important was Mexican culture in your household as you grew up?
I don't know if you could say important. It's just what I knew, right? Mm-hmm. Like what many of us know, we don't know the difference. But it was definitely, you know, funny seeing certain customs. We'd celebrate Thanksgiving, but we would also have, and Christmas, you know, and most would have turkey or ham, and, you know, there would be the occasional tamale there, or tostadas de pavo, you know, like, you know, next day people do turkey sandwiches, we would do tostadas, you know. It's just like you took things that were yours and customs that were already here, and you made them even more yours. So it's I don't know if it's important, but it's part of who I was and part of how I grew up. So it's definitely what I knew.
No, I can relate to that too. Yeah, my dad's from Argentina, and kind of the same thing where for just growing up, it was normal. And one of the things for me that was normal was just being a massive soccer fan. And then, you know, you go to school and not everybody is as, you know, in tune with soccer. Yeah. And it's kind of like, wait, I thought this is what everybody watches. So how was that for you? Because I mean, obviously soccer, you being a former soccer player yourself and now working for ESPN covering the game, how was it for you kind of going back to like your first moments with the sport, and was there a tie-in with your family and soccer as well?
Absolutely. My dad's a huge soccer fan. He's the reason I played the game. He coached adult men's league pretty much my entire life. When I can remember being a kid and kicking a soccer ball, I was at his side in these, you know, amateur Sunday leagues. So it's a big reason of why. And it's funny you mentioned going to school and kind of being like, wait a second, I thought this was popular. I was a late bloomer. And I remember being like 14, 15, going, you know, my first couple years of high school, and guys are like coming into their own, they're of age, and, you know, they're dressing better, you know, they're looking at girls. And I was just coming to school and soccer shorts, you know, and a tournament t-shirt. You know, I didn't think much of anything else besides soccer. I wouldn't even comb my hair. I was 4'11", 83 pounds, playing on the varsity team, you know, 14 years old, playing with men. Everything was just so raw, so new. But the only thing that I really knew was football, was soccer. It was like you said, I thought it was popular. And back then, I mean, I went to school, I graduated school 2000, you know, class 2000. So shows you how old I am. Back then, it wasn't anywhere near in popularity or acceptance as it is now. So I could only imagine what it's like now. But definitely back then, that wasn't the case.
No, and growing up too, at home, were there any culture clash moments? You know, because USA and Mexico have a massive rivalry when it comes to soccer, and now you're in a position where you're kind of waving both flags. Was there any kind of culture clashes at home for you to, like, you know, who do I root for, the US or Mexico?
Kind of. I mean, because, you know, I grew up watching the Mexican national team, but I also grew up watching and having my dad tell me stories of Eric Winalda and Kobe Jones because they were from Southern California, you know, and of the area. I grew up in Vegas for majority of my, what was my youth and formative years, but, you know, I was born in LA. I was raised up until a certain moment, I believe 8 or 9, in Oxnard, California, you know, in Ventura. So Southern California, soccer hotbed, lots of Latinos, but in this place, Oxnard, it was pretty much known for a few things. And one of those things was a boxing gym, a gym called La Colonia, where they had lots of, you know, prize fighters come through. Produce, you know, it's like the grape and strawberry capital of California. So a lot of immigrant farm workers, and just being an immigrant town, Latinos, Mexicans. So that's all I knew. That's all that was there for me. And it's funny to think about these cultural, I guess, clashes you talk about, because for the longest time when I was growing up, I'm Mexican, spoke Spanish, but I didn't speak with an accent. I took interest in other things. And, you know, oftentimes growing up, you were told to stop acting white or to act a certain way to prove your, I guess, Latino-ness or Mexican-ness, or in a way, just how Hispanic you are, which was ridiculous to me at the time, and even more so now when you see just how differently layered and cultural we are.
I mean, there's definitely a whole storyline there too. I mean, growing up too, for me, I mean, I obviously was nowhere near your level of skill when it came to soccer, but I remember being really young thinking, man, one day it'd be great to play for the Argentinian national team. And then my second option was the U.S. national team, and I got nowhere near either of them. So, but
you know, what's funny about that, Monty, is, and I run through this all the time, is most people have a real problem with the idea of one person, forget for a second a player, mm-hmm. you know, but one person having an affinity for more than one country. So then when you turn that patriotism into what is the sporting aspect of it, you've got a lot of pundits, you've got a lot of people, fans, who are like, I don't get this. How can you say I can play for this country if you're not from that country? Or if this doesn't go for me, I can go here. They don't realize just how unique being a dual national can be. Like, I'm sure you had a great sense of love, appreciation, admiration, and respect for Argentina as you did for the country that you live in, you know, the U.S. It doesn't make one less than the other. And people have a real hard time sometimes of differentiating what is that love and respect.
No, yeah, there's definitely some people, you know, it's like this, oh, this guy's a traitor. This person's a traitor for leaving my country and everything. Yeah. So it's definitely a hotbed, but going back to your trajectory, pretty much, what made you decide to, cause you started your career actually in Mexico with Cruz Azul. How was that for you, that decision to start in Mexico and not up here in the United States?
Well, I think it was a pretty easy decision. I spent 4 months training at Cruz Azul, and it kind of opened my eyes to what was Mexican soccer. And from there, I, you know, had a few stints in the lower divisions and then ultimately came back to the States. But the opportunity was there because there was none for me at that time in the U.S. I was living in Vegas. I believe there was a Las Vegas Quicksilver at one time, which was the A-League, the old A-League. And there was also the San Diego Soccers, which was the old indoor league. And both those teams kind of disbanded and nothing happened. And, you know, it wasn't like I grew up watching a professional environment of football or had those heroes and idols or even role models within kind of eyesight of me. You know, the closest team was the LA Galaxy. And I remember my first game where I went and watched at the Rose Bowl, Kobe Jones scoring against the Columbus Crew. I remember the exact moment. I remember, you know, thinking, wow, this is professional soccer. And they played at the Rose Bowl and it looked empty, you know. But that's what I had growing up. There wasn't an academy system. There wasn't a reserve team. I, in fact, actually ended up being of the first generation reserve league in Major League Soccer back in 2005.
Wow.
Chris Wondolowski and I, you know, were part of that first generation alumni for that reserve league. I remember playing against them when I was at the Galaxy. And that actually gave me my start with the Galaxy. But going back to your question, it wasn't like I had much opportunity elsewhere. So when this came about and I went to Mexico, I actually tried out for Pachuca. And when I talk about opportunity, it was I tried out for Pachuca. That didn't work out, third division. But there was somebody there from Cruz Azul who was like, why don't you come down here? They, you know, they're looking at players. And I ended up staying there and training for 4 months because at the time I didn't have my Mexican passport. So while I was waiting for the passport and they had plans of signing me, they put me up. You know, Casa Club paid for my food and board, room and board, and all that stuff. And I would train and ended up where there was another possibility of going playing in a second division team in Puebla. They didn't care that I didn't have a Mexican passport. They would play me as a foreign national so I could use my American passport. So I played that way. There just seemed to be more opportunity. So in the year and a half that I was in Mexico, the first stint, 2 years, I had three goes. Whereas in my whole youth career leading up to, you know, youth soccer or my professional soccer, involvement, I had zero really moments of interest from ODP teams, from colleges, from, you know, whatever you may think is the path or the correct path or a path in American soccer to get to professional soccer, I had almost zero contact with.
That's crazy to think of. I mean, how many other talented individuals like yourself were just missed through this, you know, this system, even still today. I mean, the other player you mentioned that was in a similar situation, Chris Wondolowski, is now the record goal scorer in all of MLS. And I mean, again, you must have played against countless people that probably should have gone pro and didn't get that opportunity. Now, how old were you when you went to Mexico with Cruz Azul and Puebla?
18. You're 18 years old.
You're 18 years old. So as an 18-year-old, you grew up in a Mexican-American household. How was it living in Mexico? You know, like you're 100% in it. Like, how was that kind of, you know?
That's again, a culture shock.
Yeah. How was that?
It's a culture shock. It's not like a bucket of cold water being splashed on you. It's like a bucket of bricks being thrown at you. You're like, whoa, what is going on here? My language or understanding of it wasn't as good as I thought. There's a different variant of it. You know, you're with the Chilangos, you're in a big city. There are dialects to it. There's a, like there would be in with the English, you know, or people in England, there's a rhyme cockney, their own little language, their own little jokes, innuendos, and you're completely lost. You're in a foreign country with things that are nowhere near to what you grew up with. The luxuries and the comforts of what you grew up with. All of a sudden, it took me about an hour and a half, 2 hours to get from point A to point B, even though it was probably separated by 20 miles, you know? Mm. It was just so different. All of a sudden, I was in an environment that was so cutthroat. And I'm talking about the sporting landscape, where it's this like Lord of the Flies type of mentality where there are kids who are governing kids who are all looking to get themselves and their families out of poverty, and it's like, you know, this is already a job and there's already pressure, and it was so just random, so crazy. I'd always played soccer because I enjoyed it. I never thought of it that way, and all of a sudden you were, you know, sharing bunk beds in like a little warehouse or whatever you may want to call it with other players from all across the country who are looking to make something of themselves, looking to get their families, you know, out of hardships, and are kind of like the men of the family already, the providers for their family, and they aren't making anything, you know, at such a young age. So it was very much a cutthroat mentality. It was just a little surreal.
So I imagine that once you make it, it kind of, it's this like massive, you know, achievement for you, because I mean, this competition that you're talking about pretty much of trying to get these positions, how was that when you finally made it, you know, as a professional? Cause I know, yeah, you came back to MLS, but then you went back to Mexico and you were a top goal scorer. You were a very important player for some of the most important teams in the league. How was that, that feeling of success for you?
Yeah, so for the teams that are in the semis right now, mm-hmm. Cruz Azul being one that I spent, you know, months at during my youth career, and the other three, Puebla, Santos, and what is Pachuca, I played at all of them.
So are they going to name the cup the Hercules Gomez Cup or something? They have to, right?
Yeah, one would guess so, but they're so big, they're so storied. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the crazy thing to me is, like, I grew up having franchises – come up from the ground like nothing, you know, like I saw the LA Galaxy in its at its birth, in its formation. I saw LAFC, you know, sprout out from the ashes of what was Chivas USA, you know, Inter Miami from what is David Beckham's stint with the LA Galaxy Major League Soccer, like how all these things came to be. Puebla, Chivas, Pachuca, and Pachuca's over 100 years old. Mm-hmm. Like they've got so much story to them. Just so much history. It's impossible to really put into words. So when I get to these teams, I realize very quickly the importance of where I'm at, the responsibility that comes with it. Because as I said, for me, soccer was always just fun. Football was just fun. It was a passion. But then you're in a position where you're being paid an enormous amount of money. You have an enormous amount of attention. In a country where there is no Hollywood, there is no NBA, NFL, MLB, there aren't any big leagues like that. You are the main attraction. You're in small towns that have won their place off of sporting merit, second, third division to first division, and their infrastructure of the town and the well-being of the town from a financial side depends on the club. And the emotional well-being of its residents change every weekend. I mean, when I was playing in Torreón for Santos, there was a statistic that we played on a Friday night, 9:30 at night, that when there was a bad result for Santos, domestic abuse would go up at an alarming rate like during that weekend. So you see how intertwined it is with the emotional well-being and just everyday fabric of what are these residents in these towns and the life. Like everything gets paralyzed. The Mexican national team plays, there isn't any movement. Everybody's watching the game. You know, something happens on a national level or international level with the team and it's like declared a national holiday. It makes you realize how big the sport is elsewhere. It's definitely mind-blowing.
No, you mentioned the national team. My next question actually is, how was your decision to play for the U.S. men's national team? And you actually went to the 2010 World Cup with the U.S. in South Africa. How was that decision for you? Was it an easy one? And we talked about it before a little bit, like, you know, being from these dual nationalities, was it something that for you, you were like 100%, or were you just like, oh, maybe I can play for Mexico? Yeah, how was that decision process for you?
I think it was easy, Monty, because if I'm being honest, so when I go down to Mexico in my first stint, I had made a few contacts, played at a few teams, kept in touch with a few people, people that later down in the road would be in pretty good positions to help me out. Olaf Heredia, who was my assistant coach when I was playing in that team in Puebla, that was not related, has no allegiance to what is Puebla today, but there were a team in Puebla, the town of Puebla, kept in touch with him. And over the years, played with the Galaxy and kept tabs. He was now part of what is Hugo Sanchez's national team coaching crew. And they were getting ready for the Pan American Games, and it was 2005. And he wanted to reach out to me because I was still young enough to play for the U23 team in Mexico, the Pan American Games, about going down and having them take a look at me. And I'm having a ridiculous year in 2005. Like, second half of the year, I'm doing insane. I'm scoring goals. I'm young. I'm a developmental player. I'm making no money. but we win the double, I get voted team MVP of a team that wins a double as a developmental player. Excuse me. 22 years old. And he's telling me about going and playing for the Mexican national team at the Pan American Games. But I'm getting called up for the U.S. national team. And I didn't go because of MLS Cup, but it was like a European tour. They played against Scotland. And I'm thinking to myself, one, the U.S. is all I've ever known. This is where I've been educated. This is where I was born. This is where my love for the game grew. And now I'm being, you know, asked about my availability for a full national team, because I had never played in any national team setup, whether that's U15s, U17s, U20s, U23s, nothing.
Wow.
So I've got Bruce Arena and the U.S. men's national team sending the Galaxy like, hey, you're part of a provisional roster. And then I've got the Mexican national team calling me and telling me, hey, we're maybe interested in seeing you in the Pan American Games. To me, it was easy. I mean, you can slice up a different type of factors of how you would come to a decision, but it just felt right for me on every level that I was U.S. men's national team.
Now let's pivot. And this is the last part of this interview here. Your career now as a broadcasting, I find it fascinating that when you look at, you know, a lot of the bigger companies that, you know, broadcast games on the English side, there isn't too many Latinos that are calling games or really involved in it. But you are kind of creating this kind of niche where you're actually doing both of them. You're working for ESPN Deportes and you're working for regular ESPN. How has that process been for you from the beginning? Because pretty much as soon as you retired from the game, you kind of pivoted into broadcasting. How has that process been in the last, you know, 9 or 10 years that you've been working on this?
I'm not that old. Come on. I've been working on this for about 3-4. 2016, I was still an active player for the Sounders, and I already done some like media work with Fox. So I knew it was like something I could potentially get into, and I was going to retire at the next, you know, at the end of the season. And, you know, not to divulge like details, but things didn't work out with Fox and ended up working out with ESPN. And had an offer from Univision back then, not UDN, but the ESPN one just made sense. They offered me the chance to work in, you know, both languages a little bit. I was going to be only English and help out Deportes whenever there was an event. And when I got there, we didn't have quite the same properties or rights for leagues as we do now. So there wasn't a whole lot to do. And I just moved my family out to Bristol or Connecticut. We were outside of Hartford, which is West Hartford. And Deportes is like, listen, if you guys aren't going to use him, we would love to use him for sports centers and things like that. And, all right, get some reps. And then this show asked about my availability. So I would do appearances on another show. And then this one did. So there are so many shows on Deportes, and even more so back then for ESPN, where I just got put into this rotation. And then it became like what was supposed to be a 95-5 split became like all of a sudden 70-30. And before I knew it, I'm doing more and more and more, and more opportunities are arising. And hey, how would you like to come and live in Los Angeles and host your own show in Spanish? You know, and I'm from LA, of course. That'd be beautiful. I could still do what I do in English, just out of LA, you know, out of a TVU. I've got a home studio. So it's something that just evolved. But it's funny how this persona of mine has evolved into like its own monster. I am like insanely talked about it, sometimes in a negative manner in Latin America, because they see me as like pro MLS or pro American, pro US men's national team, and in Spanish. And here in English in the States, I'm often labeled as a defender of Mexico, of Liga MX, you know, like don't defend MLS a lot. I'm very critical of, you know, US soccer and Major League Soccer. So it's very funny to see how both have taken a life of their own.
I mean, that's crazy that you've been through all this in the span of only 3 or 4 years. I think that's why I thought it was longer, because I see you pretty much everywhere. And again, you're a great follow on any, you know, social media platform as well. But to be able to do that in such a short amount of time for me is fascinating. But also, yeah, to be kind of a person at times, it feels like you're a person without a country, because it seems like both sides are chirping at you there. Now,
on social media.
That's
the crazy thing is, I'll give you the example of when I went to play at Cholos. I was a big signing for Cholos. They paid a lot of money for me from Santos, and they like finally had their U.S. men's national team player, Mexican, you know, and American player that they wanted. Did my knee at the Gold Cup, was never the player I wished I could have been for them. Mm-hmm. And there came a point where, I mean, I started off so brightly. I started off scoring a hat trick in my debut. I come on at halftime, score a hat trick, and that was like as good as it got. Didn't play very well after that. Wasn't fully fit. I couldn't get myself to the level I needed to be. And every single moment, there came a moment where every single time I touched the ball at a Estadio Caliente, where I wear in a Cholos jersey, I was booed by our own fans. And I'm not talking about like a few jeers here and there. I'm talking about the whole stadium collectively booing every time I touched the ball. To the point where I just told my family, don't come to the games anymore. Don't drive out from Vegas and come to the games. There's no use. Don't worry about it. Thank you. Blah, blah, blah. But the hate would be for 90 minutes, you know, while I played, while I touched the ball. As soon as the game ended, I'm leaving the stadium, driving my car. I would have fans, lines of fans flagging my car down, forcing me to get out, take pictures, sign jerseys, sign pictures, autograph, all these different things. Who are very polite, very, very good towards me. And that's kind of what it is on both sides now. Mm-hmm. A lot of this, I guess, I won't even say it's hate, it's just fanatism, mm-hmm. comes off of social media. But when I see people in the real world, 99.9% of them are just insanely good to me. Just ridiculously nice, very just respectful. You get your idiots here and there, but you should see the way when I went to the 2018 World Cup to cover Mexico in English, Sebastian Salazar and I went, we had a podcast called 2 on 3. We went to cover the Mexican national team in English for ESPN. So we're following around the Mexican national team. You should see the Mexican fans and how they treated me. It's like I'm a celebrity for being infamous, but they were all very respectful. It's just a crazy thing.
It's insane. And I mean, one of the episodes that we want to do eventually is we do want to talk about this strange fandom when it comes to sports, where, I mean, in different cultures, it means more. I mean, we talked about how it is in Mexico and Argentina. It's the same way, especially with soccer. You know, it's kind of this tie to the sport that's at times it might seem as an outsider a little too much. But I think for someone like you, you've been through so many of these obstacles, like you're telling us, so many, you know, you've seen a lot, pretty much. You've seen a lot of ups and downs, and I'm all about messaging. That's the corny side of me with this podcast. I love to ask our guests, what's a message that you would give to somebody? And you've probably been asked this 1,000 times, but from your standpoint as, you know, somebody who's Latino American, and has been able to accomplish so much and is still accomplishing even much more. And I hope for the best for you and everything you wish to accomplish, you keep doing it because you're such a role model. What's a message you would give to other people that are listening?
Don't stop. I've had 1,000 doors closed on me, you know, in my face. No, thank you. Not looking, not big enough, not strong enough, not good enough. I was never the best player growing up at any level. I may be the only player from the city of Las Vegas to play in a World Cup, but I definitely wasn't the best player, by no means. But it's just resilience. While everybody else kept falling off, I just kept getting better a little bit at a time. And I never stopped because maybe I'm too thick-headed, hard-headed to listen, but I never listened to anybody who would tell me no.
Thank you so much, Hercules Gomez, for taking the time to talk to us here in Radio Teco. Much appreciated, and the best of luck with everything you got going forward for you.
Hey, it was a pleasure, Monty. Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening to Radio Teco, the podcast of El Tecolote, California's longest-running bilingual community Latino newspaper. If you enjoyed listening to this episode and are looking for more of our content, please visit our website, eltecolote.org. And if you value bilingual storytelling and would like to support our next 50 years of community journalism, please consider making a donation or sign up to volunteer.